Good evening. This is the regular Thursday, May 2nd, 2019 meeting of the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board. We're in the Veterans Memorial Building on Surf Street in Morro Bay. We do have a quorum, although two of our members are not here at this time, and that's Gene Dowdy and Dana McClish. So we'll call the meeting to order, given that we do have a quorum, and please join me in a moment of silence. Thank you. Pledge of Allegiance. Lynn?
Can you lead us?
Ready? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Let the record show that Mr. McClish is with us. Don't run. We're good. We're good. It's all good. It's all good. So the next item is Chair, Advisory Board, Member, and Liaison Announcements. And our first announcement is that we have modified our meeting agenda format to bring it into conformance with the City Council's current meeting agenda format. So the traditional B items, which is general reports and appearances, have been deleted from the agenda. And appearances, such as this evening's Quota Fund status report, will take place during this portion of the meeting, along with board member, council liaison, and staff announcements. We also now have a consent agenda section. That's the A section of the agenda, which will feature approval of the prior minutes, the Harbor Department staff report, and other agenda items as we will determine from time to time. Should any board member want to comment on a consent agenda item, for instance, you see a needed correction in the prior minutes, or you want to discuss something in the Harbor Department staff report, you would state that you want to pull that item and you would identify it. Then it will be addressed after a motion to approve the consent agenda and after a public comment regarding the consent agenda. So it will be the next order of business after the consent agenda, if you decide to pull something. And traditionally, or historically, we've had our business items in the C section. There is no longer a C section. Those are now in the B section. Any questions on the board, how that all functions? Okay, good. Lynn?
No?
Oh. You're just amused?
You've made yourself look for your
family. Well, good. Doesn't always happen. So let's start with board announcements. Charisse? Thank you. Dana, could you refresh our memory on the Marine swap meet, please?
June 29th, we have the Morro Bay Marine swap meet. It is put on by Friends of the Harbor Department, the Morro Bay Maritime Museum, and the Morro Bay Youth Sailing Foundation. Together, those three nonprofits are putting this together. We already have a lot of the spaces reserved, so if you still want to do that, you need to contact one of those three organizations, hopefully the Friends of the Harbor Department, and get your space. As far as food vendors, we already have those filled up. Thank you.
Wow. It's going to be an extravaganza.
I would hope so.
Yeah, yeah. And if folks want to donate items to any of those nonprofits that you mentioned, how to support the swap meet, those organizations' activities at the swap meet, how would they do that?
Well, you would get a hold of either one, you know, any of those organizations through their websites. Of course, you can go to mbysf.org, and I will happily take your donations.
That being the Youth Sailing Foundation?
Correct.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks. Mark?
None at this time.
Okay. Lynn?
Nothing.
Jeremiah?
Yeah, I guess the biggest thing is salmon opened, commercial salmon fishing opened May 1st, and there's been few fish out front. There's been more down towards Port San Luis and south. There's some pretty decent scores there today. I think the highest I heard was about 40 at noontime. So that was very good. Anyways, the crab fishing unfortunately ended April 15th, and Laguerre is out of the water and stacked for all the crabbers. Still some black cod going on, and probably Eric will want to expound on this, but I think our ice machine is if it's not completed, the rehabilitation of the machine, if it's not completed, it will be hopefully tomorrow, and we'll have all the ice we need. So that's it. Thanks.
King salmon?
Yes, kings.
King salmon. Yeah, thank you. Thanks. Councilperson McPherson?
Well, you can tell from your agenda that we're clearly entering budget time. I see that you're going to review the Harbor Department budget, but the full council will be reviewing the full budget at two study sessions, May 14th and May 16th. And the May 14th is before our regular council meeting. So if you have interests outside of the Harbor Department, and for anybody watching, please come to the study sessions. Thanks.
Thank you. Harbor Department staff, announcements?
Thank you, but no, just as Jeremiah said, the ice machine, the $100,000 cable committee grant funded project is moving along. They came in on, I believe, Tuesday, dropped in the equipment by crane, took away the old stuff, upgrading it to the latest and greatest environmentally sensitive refrigerant, getting rid of the old R22 and going to some other new refrigerant. And I believe within the next day or hopefully day, they'll have it up and running and making ice. So that'll be a big improvement to get that ice back and get that.
That's anticipated to be completed by when, please?
I believe it's in the next day or two. Mm-hmm. It was almost not plug and play, but it was pretty close. It was just tear the old one out, put the new one in, plug it in, hook up the refrigeration connections, and away you go. It was less involved than I thought it was when I was thinking, but they're moving right along. They're doing good. Race Engineering is a company at Santa Monica Seafood. That's their refrigeration company down in L.A. they deal with, so they put in the proposal, and it's going to cost about $100,000.
Okay. Thanks to the Cable Committee. Okay, and that brings us to an update from the Quota Fund. And Dwayne, when you give your report, please don't assume that anybody knows what it is.
Okay, that's great. If anybody has questions while we're moving through it, just let me know. But I'm Dwayne Oberhoff, the Executive Director of the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund, here to give a annual kind of update. This, I believe, is our third time doing this. Normally I have a PowerPoint with a bunch of numbers and stuff on it, but I'm going to do a little bit different tonight, talk about some of the stuff we've been doing and some other stuff in the fishery. Back in January of this year, the four quota funds in California, there's not just Morro Bay, there's a quota fund up in Monterey, Half Moon Bay, and Fort Bragg, all came together in Monterey. Myself and three of our board members attended. Jeremiah was one of the attendees, Chris Kubiak, and Ed Backus is one of our board members, but he's located in Oregon. We come together annually to discuss a variety of different things, things like what's working for the quota funds individually, what's not working, what are some of the challenges that we all need to either overcome individually or all together, some of the current conditions and challenges within our respective ports, and discuss if those challenges are California-wide.
Could you briefly define what a quota fund is, please?
Yeah, so the quota funds, in particular our quota fund in Morro Bay, we're a nonprofit that holds fishing assets in the form of quota shares and trawl permits in the trawl IFQ fishery. It's basically access or rights to the fishery. Let's see here. Moving on, back just a couple of weeks ago on April 23rd, the Quota Fund coordinated and invited Mr. Bob Dooley to Morro Bay. Mr. Dooley is on the PFMC, the Pacific Fishery Management Council, and he actually fills the California seat on the council. Fishermen from both Morro Bay and Port San Luis were invited to attend a casual sit-down, that way the fishermen could get to know Mr. Dooley. Mr. Dooley could get to know the fishermen. Everybody could talk about what the concerns were in the fishery, but not just the groundfish fishery. He represents all sectors in California. I think it went well. We actually had more fishermen from Port San Luis come than I was expecting, which was really good. Another item is back in 2014, when the Quota Fund was formed, we acquired a large portfolio of quota share and permits. We're in the process now of a second acquisition, and that hopefully will be done, but over the next probably 3 to 4 weeks. And when that's done, Morro Bay, the Quota Fund of Morro Bay and Morro Bay and the Central Coast will have one of the largest portfolios of quota share and permits on the West Coast. So another topic is since 2018, the Quota Fund has been a member of the Fishing Communities Coalition. It's basically an association of community-based small boat commercial fishing groups that represent over 1,000 people. In ports and harbors from Alaska to Maine, all the way down to the Gulf Coast. And it's just a group that kind of unifies the fishermen, gives them a little bit stronger voice. We participate in monthly phone calls. We talk about a variety of topics, local, regional, national issues, things like the Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization, electronic monitoring, which is a big topic these days. We've also participated in numerous visits to D.C. to participate in Hill meetings. I know Jeremiah has gone to at least one or two of them, and Chris Kubiak on our board, he is in D.C. as we speak. This is more fishery-wide, but it affects Morro Bay. Some good news to actually report, but, you know, after decades of intense fishing, numerous rockfish species were declared overfished, things like canary and boccaccio and yellow eye and cow cod. Back in 2007, Morro Bay experienced, you know, the lowest landings we've ever had. And then in 2011, when the IFQ system started, for the trawl IFQ system, that is, there were about 7 species of rockfish that were declared overfished. And since then, which is 2019 right now, all but 2 of them have been taken off the list. So the only thing remaining is cow cod and yellow eye. Cow cod is still a really big deal for us. The catch limits are extremely low. It affects any of the trawl fishermen fishing in California. I believe right now the annual vessel limit is only about 580 pounds. So it really limits what you can do in the fishery. It really hampers going out and catching some of the healthy stocks like chili peppers and And actually, bacchaccio now that it's not overfished, is becoming a target species, which is really good. We could potentially have big landings of bacchaccio in this port if everything goes right. That's all I had for my report, unless anybody had questions.
Sharice? Dana? Mark? Lynn? No. Jeremiah?
There we go. I was just wondering, at the new acquisition, how much of a difference will that make in the portfolio in general from what the fund?
In how many pounds?
Yes, what will the significant species forth?
It's not a lot of fish, but I consider it fairly significant because the original acquisition we got, for the most part, didn't include a lot of the overfished species. So in the second one, we will be getting some canary rockfish, which we didn't have before, which is great because they're plentiful off of Morro Bay, dark blotch rockfish, yellow eye rockfish, and we already had some bacchaccio and cow cod. So it's going to be, not only is it going to increase the size of our portfolio, but the diversity is good too, because some of these species are needed to go out and catch some of these healthy stocks, and like I said before, like chili pepper, lean cod, things like that.
Thanks, Dwayne. Good job.
Thanks.
Dwayne, how is a portfolio acquisition funded?
Well, a couple different ways. One of the big ways is a loan. So there's a group out there called the California Fisheries Fund, and that's where we received our loan back in 2014. And so we have a loan. Basically, it's basically like a mortgage. We have a monthly payment, everything.
And where do the funds come from to service the debt?
We generate revenue, and we pay it ourselves. We receive no outside funding for any of this.
And what are the sources of that revenue?
Leasing quota. Yep. So we lease quota to fishermen. They pay us a lease rate, and that over the year that just accumulates, and we have like I said, we have monthly payment that we make.
How many fishermen are currently participating in the Morro Bay Quota Fund?
Well, locally we have one guy right now fishing fixed gear for sable fish. Last year we had a trawler come down from Half Moon Bay. That was his second year. I spoke to him about 3 weeks ago. He said he's still coming down. I think he is has hauled his boat out, and he's working on it right now. I've been trying to reach him and haven't been able to get a hold of him. But this year we should have two. But because we own so much quota, and a lot of it can't be caught here just by the nature of the way the allocations and the species work, we lease a lot of it to out of the area, just because some of the species just can't be caught here. And so we generate revenue that way, too, from leasing out of the area.
What percentage or proportion of the portfolio is currently leased?
Overall?
Mm-hmm.
A low proportion of it, and the only reason is because there's certain species that we have where we own enormous amounts. I mean, right now, I think this year we'll have probably close to 8 million pounds of quota available. Some of those species, like Dover sole or other flatfish, which would be like sand dabs and wreck sole and English sole, we own millions and millions and millions of pounds of it. So, I mean, I don't know what the number is right now off the top of my head for this year. I believe last year was... I think it was close to 17% that we leased out, but some of those species, there's no market for it. There's no lease market because there's so much available in the fishery already.
So you're in a competitive marketplace in terms of your portfolio.
In a little bit. For some of the species, we are, if we decide to lease it out of the area. Like I said, though, some of the species, like Dover sole, because everybody in the fishery own so much of their own, there's not a lease market for that quota. I wish there was, because there's a lot of it out there.
And when you say that the fleet owns, you mean there are active permits that are not quota fund?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most of the permits that are out there, most of the quota share owners are fishing businesses, individuals. Yeah, and like I said, everybody owns a lot of certain species, but then they also, some people don't own any of the other species. So some of the species that are really desirable or that they don't own a lot of, like Petrolli sole, sablefish north are very valuable species that are very easy to lease. Other stuff, like I mentioned, Dover sole, some of the other species, I couldn't lease them if I tried.
I have lots of questions about the way the market works, but that's okay. What was the approximate value of Morro Bay quota fund landings in 2018?
The landing data doesn't come out annually like you would think. So the only available data right now is from 2017 through California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is where one of the places I get the data, because it breaks it out nicely. The data for 2018 won't come out until, I'm guessing, like July or August of this year. So I could either come back or email the board, or we could talk about it at our next update next year.
I think it's a fall. This is a really important element of the commercial fishery activity in Morro Bay. So a critical element, actually. So the more we understand, the happier I think we'll be. Anything else for Dwayne? No. Go ahead.
I would like to just add the reason. So the quota fund didn't just happen. It was with the federal government and new rule, it's so very difficult to explain because it's so complicated, but I'll make it brief. They made a new rule, and they actually gave ownership of 46% of all the groundfish on the West Coast, not just California, to individual fishermen holding certain permit. It was a trawl permit. When that happened, the port of Morro Bay would have been left with zero possession of any groundfish. Nobody in this town qualified for a permit.
On the basis of?
They didn't have the trawl permit necessary to acquire your acquisition.
And who was they?
The federal government. NOAA. So this was a project, a NOAA project. So they, upon completion, we would have had zero groundfish for people fishing out of Morro Bay. And, by the way, Port San Luis, I believe. So in any case, recognizing that fact, we began this process, and the reason we would have been left, by the way, with no qualifying permits here is because the Nature Conservancy had purchased all of them just prior to this happening. Just good luck on their part. Immediately prior to it happening. So we did make deals with the Nature Conservancy and bought back a lot of these fish, and we took a loan to do it. But we now possess a large share, and I believe 5 permits.
Soon to be 6. Yep.
Soon to be 6 permits. So it's more complicated. We better save it for another meeting. The reasons we are not fishing more of our permits, to be continued.
Thank you. I'm making a note for future agenda.
So would you say there'd be, if there were more permits, then there would be more fishing here in Morro Bay, more revenues coming in?
No, we have 5 permits now and a 6th on the way, and a massive amount of fish. So we have no shortage of permits, and we have no shortage of fish. But
just for reference, do you have that 2017 number?
On the value of the fish landed in Morro Bay? Off the top of my head, I don't. I can get it both for Morro Bay quota fund landings and the whole port. Those easy numbers to get for 17.
And the quota fund is solvent. Our bills are paid. Dwayne is our manager. He's an excellent manager. And we've been able to meet our debt.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well. We have a fully funded six-month operating reserve. Things are going well. So,
if you don't mind, I'm going to jump in, and I was going to go this direction anyhow, and Dana kind of spurned it a little bit, and maybe Dwayne can fill in the gaps a little bit more. So, as Jeremiah said, and I'm on the board as well of the quota fund, the resource is very healthy. We have permits. We have quota. As Dwayne said, there's a lot of it that just doesn't exist around here, so you don't fish it here. Part of the equation on why we don't have more participation is the regulations and the observers and the fishery. It's complicated and convoluted, and you need an attorney and a biologist and a research scientist on your boat to be able to get involved in it because it's so convoluted. But the other part of the equation that is kind of not talked about a lot or not really well known is a market. You need a market to be able to, even though the fish are out there, you've got to have a market to sell it to, and there's not a lot of market opportunity here. We're pretty limited. We've got a couple buyers, one really that services out of the area, that's Santa Monica Seafood next to our office. The other's Giovanni, and he's mostly just local and serves his own mail order system. And so developing markets is going to be one of the key future things that's going to help the health of the quota fund and future participation. We actually had a board meeting two weeks ago, where we talked a lot about that. That's something a lot of people don't understand is that, yeah, there's fish, yeah, there's fishermen, yeah, there's boats, there's quota, but you got to have a market, and the markets aren't that easy to develop. And I'd ask Dwayne maybe to jump in and talk a little bit about the research fund, maybe in the kind of the war chest we've built up, and that's the other part of the quota fund that a lot of people may not understand.
Yeah, so our bylaws state very clearly that we create a research fund, and 50% of our net revenue gets allocated to that research fund annually. Back in 2015, I believe it was, we issued grants totaling around $16,000. Since then, we've been allocating funds every year, but not dispersing them, because we're very fortunate. We have Cal Poly professor on our board, Dean Wendt, and he basically has said to us, and I think we all agree, is that you can do more with more money. So we've been just holding that until we have a big enough chunk that we can fly an RFP and do a little bit bigger, more meaningful work. And so right now, I think after the end of this year, we'll have over $100,000 in our research fund. Maybe at our fall meeting, the board may decide at that point to consider allocating or dispersing those funds through an RFP. We'll have to see, though.
What are the three hot topics?
Just research offshore, things that directly affect our fishermen. Anything that's going to affect or benefit our fishermen are things that are going to be considered more favorable for dispersing funds too.
Can you give us an example?
Like something to do like rockfish monitoring, maybe some long-term monitoring. I know that one of the first ones we funded had to do with, I believe I'm not mistaken, it's been so long now, had to do with rockfish monitoring in one of the MPAs, looking at rockfish inside there. And so, you know, anything that would help benefit our fishermen through data collection that could help inform regulators, you know, passing that information to the PFMC or even the state agency would be something we would be interested in looking at.
Dana, what was our previous funding for? We did some research funding prior to this. That would have been an example, I would think.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. We funded two different projects, and one was more wasn't really a research project. The one was through I'm sorry, I'm blanking on their name, but Cal Poly Sea Grant professor, and the study went out and basically monitored some spots for rockfish. It was before my time as executive director, so I don't recall. But after that study, it was realized it wasn't enough money to really do a lot, and so the goal right now is to have a bigger chunk of money, because as most of you guys know, running a boat is extremely expensive, so.
Okay. Anything else? Dwayne, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time. Have a good night.
Appreciate it. Okay, that brings us to a public comment period for any item that is not on the agenda or for any item for whom somebody cannot remain. And we have no public with us in person this evening, and we don't take phone-ins, at least not currently. So we'll move on.
She was here for public comment.
Yeah, she was. She got a phone call, so.
Well, that's, oh. You know.
I don't know if she's still up front or.
Ma'am, are you here for public comment?
Yes, I am.
It's that time.
Thank you. Sorry.
Hi. My name is Mimi Goldberg, and I've been a resident of Morro Bay since 1989. I'm here to address, we really, really need trash cans put back down at the Rock. I understand that you guys want everyone to pack out their trash. If it was a perfect world, that would be great. But, you know, some people are from different places and they were raised different ways and they don't grasp that. They don't, you know, beachgoers come from all different places. People don't want to haul out soiled, soggy diapers or napkins or cans, etc. I'd like to see Morro Bay set a precedence and be a beach city that other cities look up to. And other beach towns can say, that's great, that's how we should do it. I've spoken with parks maintenance and employees and a lot of residents, and they all agree we need trash cans back there. Even today I spoke with a lifeguard at Morro Bay, and he said people are coming up to him to ask him to throw their trash away for him, for them. My suggestion... Up in Ocean Beach in San Francisco, they tried the same thing. They took the trash cans away. Didn't work. It was a failure. It's a failure. And so my suggestion is, okay, you know how the Snowy Plover, the little Del Mar kids drew those nice little signs, and it's really cool. Maybe Morro Bay High School could do the laminated signs saying, give a hoot, don't pollute, leave no imprint, pack out what you pack in, but also, please, put some trash cans. I'm willing to volunteer my services. I pick up trash on the sand spit. I go, and I enjoy kayaking over there, and I enjoy picking up trash, and I do, and that's what I do for the city. It just, it all blows, like, over there. My suggestion is that we need more volunteers, trash cans, and even maybe more workers. But we really, really, we need trash cans down at the Rock. And a handicapped person, they can't go from their vehicle to the bathrooms. There's no sign that even says, you know, look behind you. I went after the Kite Festival and I picked up all the trash on Sunday afternoon. It's okay. Anyhow. That's okay. My passion. My daughter graduated Morro Bay High. She's a longboarder. And thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Harbor Department, do we want to talk about the possibilities?
Talk about it in what fashion? It's not an agendized item, so if you've got some questions, I can answer some questions, but we're not going to have a discussion about it.
I understand. Some
my question is, relative to the city's org chart, theoretically, trash in that area would be the responsibility of which department?
The city's contract for all its trash services, including the rock, is done through Public Works, through the Janine Burlingame and all the contracts that she handles for the city, including with Morro Bay Garbage.
Okay, thank you.
We ultimately pay for it, but that's where the contract is managed.
I mean, the Harbor Fund pays for it.
Yeah, Harbor Fund pays for it, correct.
Okay. So let the record show that Mr. Dowdy's with us. Sure.
I have to apologize.
It's okay, dear.
I just acquired a nice little 7 or 8 foot sailing boat. I had all the intentions of showing up here. I got to the office and I go, this is a great day, great wind to go sailing with. And all thoughts of responsibility went with the taffrail and I was all gone. And got home and thought, I'm going to relax and have some ice cream and enjoy the day. And all of a sudden I go, Harbor Advisory Board, I've got to get over there. So I apologize, I'm late.
All thoughts of responsibility went over the taffrail. Nicely done, Gene. Nicely done. I would have to think long and hard to come up with that. So, Gene, we're up to our consent calendar because we have a new format. And so our consent calendar is item A. It has three items on it, A1, A2, A3. The first one is approval of minutes from March 13th. The second one is approval of minutes from April 4. And the third one is the Harbor Department status report, which is, you know, embedded in the agenda. Does anyone want to pull any of those items? Okay, so I need a motion to approve the consent calendar.
So moved.
Seconded.
Okay, moved and seconded. Any discussion? Lori, is this where you wanted me to ask for public comment on the consent? Before. Okay, well, we're going to table the motion. It's on duly noted. Is there any public comment on the consent calendar? This is the first time we've done this, so give me a break. Seeing no public comment on the consent calendar, the motion has been moved and seconded. There is no discussion. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? None. Carries. Thank you. That takes us to Section B, the business items. The first one is an update from the Boatyard Marine Services Facility Ad Hoc Committee, and our chair is with us this evening.
Thank you. Last month I wasn't here, and Ron told you about a federal funding handbook for marine transportation infrastructure programs that the ad hoc members were looking at. This was something that Eric, the harbor director, had passed on to me. And there is about 80 programs in this handbook. The ad hoc members were assigned 8 different programs out of those 80 to investigate and give brief synopsis as to the applicability to the planning, design, construction, outfitting, and operation of a boatyard facility. 4 of these programs looked promising, so they are the Economic Development Assistant Program, Planning Program and Technical Assistant Program, Infrastructure for Rebuilding America Program, and the Small Shipyard Grant Program. Looking at these, there were others that we looked at, and you look at the title, and you go, that's got some possibilities. As you go through, this is the reason we were tasked with this. Members Jeremiah, Lexi Bell, Pandora Nash, and Ron Reisner, and myself looked at different ones. And as you look at them, you start realizing, oh, this isn't going to work, or this one really is going to work. And so of those 8, we did find those 4. And then along the way, you start seeing other programs as you're investigating the ones you're looking at. And so it can be overwhelming a little bit. And then as we read through some of them, like the DBW one, the big, which I know Eric has gone after time and time again for the launch ramp, you know, it states that this is probably 37 hours of work just for the application. And that means it'd probably be, you know, a week or two for me. So the need for someone to help us do this has kind of fell into place also. Pandora has a friend, and we're in contact with this person who is a professional grant writer, and we're going to meet with him. He's just going to give us some details and some potential other resources into how to look at this and how the applications could be done. And I told him, well, the first grant we need is a grant for a grant writer. So he probably heard that many a time. But anyways, look forward to reporting more on this in the future. Thank you.
Questions? Gene?
No.
Jeremiah?
No.
Lynn? Mark?
Just recapping what our status is currently with the boatyard, we do not have an RFP outstanding, do we, currently?
No.
We do not. The RFP that we put out got no responses. The committee helped me do some revisions to it. In order to put those back out, I need to route it back through the city council. And then we started working on looking at potential grant opportunities for it as well. As you saw in my, hopefully saw, and I think I brought up at the last meeting budget-wise, I do not have it in my budget this year to fund that feasibility study. Not to say it couldn't be changed, but I did not put it in looking at other priorities. So that's where the grant opportunities really kind of became important to start looking at trying to pursue those. But the next step would have to be go to City Council to get approval of a revised RFP.
Sharice? So, Dana, what, in terms of the ad hoc committee's activities in this particular regard, what are next steps?
Well, I'm going to meet with this gentleman and kind of go from there. He's going to give me some, you know, his view of things and the possibilities and what we need, you know, commitment-wise or whatever else, you know, maybe possibly from the city as far as what we're looking at, we're trying to get grants for. As far as the members, I would just wait to hear our next move.
From you?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Okay. Next item is B2, update from the Finance and Budget Ad Hoc Committee, and that chair is with us this evening.
We have an extensive staff report. I think that probably our best bet is to begin there and entertain questions as we go through.
Okay. All right. Board? Okay. Thank you. Next item is B3, update from the Eelgrass Ad Hoc Committee, and that chair is with us this evening.
And we have not met since our last discussion, our last board meeting. So I have nothing new to report.
Refresh our memory, please, Lynn. What was it? What was a next step or steps?
Having a budget to get Anchor, QEA, and I suppose Eric to go talk to some of the regulatory agencies to see if a modified in-lieu fee program would be acceptable to them. And then we would have to talk with the NEP, with Lexi and her board at the NEP, to make sure that they would be able to step up and do some of the kind of mitigation that the agencies would require.
And without regard to the availability of staff to support the first action item you talked about, help me recall, do we have a number from QEA for their participation in that?
We did not at that, after our last meeting. I think Eric was going to perhaps broach the subject with Jack and see what it might cost and if there is anything in the budget to do that.
And I've been working with Jack at Anchor. He is willing. The main regulator, the first regulator to go to would be Army Corps of Engineers, which are down in Ventura, which is where he works. He's willing to go there basically on his dime and go meet with them for an hour or so and just see how receptive they are and get sort of a first blush feel on how it may go or whether they just flat out reject it. So he and I have been working on trying to figure out a schedule for me to get down there. I'd be going down and maybe take a member or two from the committee, but with our both of our workloads, we just haven't figured out a date yet and the time that works for the Corps, but that would be our next step, just see if the Corps is even receptive.
Do you think it's feasible in May?
Yeah, it could be. May, June, yeah.
May, June. Okay.
Don't want to make a promise can't keep.
Okay. Okay. So, Ms. McPherson, is the City Council, to your knowledge, still interested in the Harbor Advisory Board providing council with a eelgrass mitigation policy concept as you directed us to do, not you personally, as the council directed us to do
I really cannot speak for the council at this point. It's something that would need to be discussed, I think, when we're talking about goals and objectives, which we will hopefully finalize in the next couple of months. So I this should come probably through Eric to see if that's still a goal that we want to keep on the council's agenda for next year.
Okay, good counsel. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, anything for Lynn? Board? No? Okay. Eric, ready to move on? Okay. Okay, B4. Update on the Harbor Department lease management policy process. Cherise?
Okay, we are currently working on what is fair market rent for different places such as government agencies like Coast Guard, nonprofits such as aquariums or museums of sort, and then just general retail, which would be restaurants, gift shops, and other things of the like. We've been looking up and down the coastline and comparing, and we are currently finding that the base rents for most of them are supporting evidence that we are in line with the similar regions along the coast. As far as percentages and types of businesses that they charge different businesses, percentages, everyone is all over the map as far as that goes.
You mean, when you say percentage, did you mean percentage rent?
Yes, the percentage rent over and above or part of base rent. Everybody's at 0 or 3 or 10 or 5, and it doesn't necessarily mean each one, retail is always this or, fish markets are always this. They're each one individually up and down the board is up and down the map is different. So currently we are not the lowest and we're not the highest. So more research is needed to see where we lie. Specifics like if the building is owned, like the improvements on the ground are owned by the agency that, us, Harbor Department, would be the owners of the building, or if it's an improvement made by the leaseholder and what their percentages are, because if you see ours, it's almost doubled if the property and the improvements are owned by the Harbor Department. So we need to delineate which ones are building leases or ground leases. And once we have that information, we're putting together a table of all the different places and what their rates are based on those, so then we can more clearly define where we lie in that.
Okay. Questions, comments? Gene?
Yeah, in your analysis, would you take in square footage of the lease site or the building? Because that's got to be one of the functions.
Right. At this time, we're looking at the fair market and what other people are charging, and right. some of them are working on that. But mostly it appears to be percentages just based on what the gross revenue is. It's not necessarily based on square footage.
Okay.
Anybody else? Charisse, to the extent that you have a sense of it, when will this task, you're working in tasks, right? Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah.
When will the working group wrap up this particular task, and what's the next one?
Okay, well, it's a case-by-case basis, and this particular one we've met twice now, and we're going to go one more time just because this is a really important part of it. Some of them will be really short, and we can get through a couple of topics within one meeting, but this one, I think, needs a little bit more research in order for us to answer it. So it's not necessarily a cut and dry, knowing what is going to take and how long it's going to be. But I'd have to look at where we are. You want to answer where we are and what the next one is?
Yeah, I'll jump in and try and finish answering or help answer that question. As Sheree said, fair market value is a pretty important issue, so we spend a little extra time on it, and we're doing this sort of task-wise, getting something done, putting it in the folder, and then moving on to the next. Our next meeting is May 23rd. I suspect unless something major earth-shattering comes out of the research that the groups are doing right now, we should be able to wrap up the fair market part at our next meeting. And what will happen is we'll discuss it as a group, language that we want to adopt and put in will be discussed, and then Lori and I take all that input and then eventually write it into the policy document. And then the subsequent meeting, hopefully we get the new language in. The group looks at it, okays it. Yeah, this is what we talked about last time, and we put that one in the folder and move on. So I suspect May 23rd, like I said, unless something big changes or some big revelation comes out of the research, we should be done with that part of it, at least as far as the group discussion goes at the next meeting.
Given that your research, the working group's research is finding that the percentage rent element, or sorry, percentage gross element of rents are quite varied, and given that the same is true for the existing leases on the Titleist Trust lands in Morro Bay, what's the resolution of that? Is there an intent on the part of the working group to establish guidelines?
We're trying to, as Sheree said, the base rent, you know, they're largely have the same sort of base of how they're established, and the percent of the appraised value of the property is pretty common. 8% is very common. It's the percentage rents that are a little all over the map, and part of the reason they may be over the map is because in the research we've done so far, we hadn't necessarily determined, like for instance, if we were looking at the city of Santa Barbara's, I'm just using that as an example, and their percentages were 10%. Well, were those building leases or those ground leases? We didn't had that little bit of data was missing, so that's one of the things that the groups are researching right now. But our intent at the end of the day is to formulate what we would like the policy to be in terms of base and percentage rents in the policy itself. Of course, that's all negotiable items with existing leases, but we're just trying to not reinvent the wheel and see what other jurisdictions have and see what the norm is. And as far as the next item goes on the list, I don't have one off the top of my head either.
What is the group finding as to how other jurisdictions are dealing with the appraised value?
They're just hiring qualified real estate appraisers, qualified property appraisers like we do, appraisal companies. I don't think the group has necessarily researched what sort of appraisers or how they do it. It's just we found that it's based on the appraised value of the property, and I'm assuming that it's done with real estate appraisers, licensed real estate appraisers.
Okay, of which there is a universe of, as with any other profession, in terms of their background, experience, applicable background and experience, applicable to waterfront lease properties such as exist in the title and trust areas of Morro Bay. So I for one, would be very interested to know if the update process that the city is going through is going to include criteria for an appraiser. What are the qualifications? Who's an appropriate appraiser? For instance, a commercial real estate appraiser out of San Luis, I would respectfully suggest, unless that individual has extensive experience with applicable properties, is not qualified to appraise our particular title and trust waterfront properties. That's an opinion.
It is an odd specialty, these properties. We had historically used a firm down in Santa Maria, Reeder and Gilman, one of the principals of that, unfortunately passed a couple of years ago, and so we stopped using him. The firm we did find was a firm that was familiar with title and trust appraisals, had actually worked, I think, with or for Reeder and Gilman in the past, so he had experience with it. But we didn't have any criteria to go on when we went and searched for an appraiser once Reeder and Gilman stopped doing it and closed their shop down. We found who we found.
I would encourage the lease policy update to include consideration of such criteria. I mean, I do appraisals for a living, among other things, and there are things that I am qualified to appraise, and there are many, many things that I am not qualified to appraise, and people ask me to do it. You got to know what you don't know.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else on that one? Okay. Thanks. So B5. B5 is a presentation on the current budget development status of the Harbor Operating Equipment Replacement and Accumulation Funds. So it's probably entirely appropriate for you to give us an opening. And put it in the context of the very quickly in the city's budget process and then the department's budget process, please.
I will do that. I don't have all the dates for, and maybe Councilwoman McPherson does have all those in the top of her head, but we are in the middle of budget development process right now. Every department has submitted their budget to finance. And we go to city council, and I'm going to phone a friend over here, May 14, 16, Marlis?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. We have our first budget workshops, the 14th and the 16th, where we'll start taking public input and have staff discussion. The basic process is finance develops our initial budgets. They plug in the known quantities that they have, such as personnel costs and insurance costs, legal and a few other items that they develop, plug that into us. We take our budgets. With my budget, unlike the rest of the city, we also have a revenue element, unlike police and fire and public works, where they're just spending money. Although community development makes a good amount of money through their permits, so they have a revenue part as well. We have a very significant element of revenue. In fact, it's revenue that has to meet all of our expenses, and so we're charged with bringing a balanced budget on both ends of the scale. We do that. Our current budget is a little over $2 million. We go through and have a pretty good idea of what our and I'll get into the details here on some of the lines here a little bit further. We have a pretty good idea what our base rents are because they all get adjusted by CPI every year, and Lori gets her most of her CPI numbers from the Department of Labor in early spring, and so she's able to calculate what our base rents are. Percent rents, we don't know. That's always going to be a little bit of a guess. We look at our past year's actual performance. We look at the economy and sales tax trending and transient occupancy tax trending and just try and get a general feel of how the economy's doing and put on an estimate of what we think this coming year might do in terms of what it did the year before. We don't get our percent rents until July, so until the fiscal year is over, so it doesn't do us any good in budgeting in terms of trying to predict what the future will be. We also use Management Partners' 10-year budget forecast model that they developed a few years ago, and you know, we continue to update and plug in the actual new numbers into it, so that helps inform our process as well. The last couple of years, our budget is somewhat stabilized at about the $2 million range. A few years ago, during the economic recovery, it was pretty difficult to figure out where we were going because we were on a pretty good positive revenue trajectory. And so each year over the past year, it was doing a little bit better. We seem to have leveled off, although we're still on a little bit of an upward climb. So from the revenue standpoint, we're pretty well stabilized. Expenses, as I say, there's certain finance fixed expenses that they send to us. And then we go in and look at, for expense-wise, for my lifeguard program, I have a pretty good idea what our costs are going to be there. Harbor Patrol reserves, we know what the costs are going to be there, fuel, those sorts of things. But we'll also look at what our current year is trending and how we're spending. We get regular updates from finance, and we can also go in and look at our budget reports and see where we're doing, and I can look at a particular line item and see how we're doing on, say, equipment repair, and if we're trending above where we are in the year in terms of, if we're halfway through the year and we spent more than 50% of our money, maybe next year we need to adjust that line item up a little bit and another one down, and so forth and so on. So that's a couple month long process. We've submitted our budget, and that's what I'll get into a little bit later. Barring any major changes in department structure or levels of services, our expenses are relatively stable. We're still going through reconciliation of PERS retirement fund issues. That presents one of the big funding challenges, and again, I'll get into some detail a little bit later on that side. We're not anticipating any significant revenue changes in this upcoming year or any major significant expense changes. We're pretty much status quo. Our master fee schedule is being revised. We haven't had a master fee study done in probably well over a decade. The master fee list has been updated year to year, but it's usually been by a CPI number. We hired a firm last fall, revenue consultants, and they've been working very diligently on the master fee study and master fee list, not just our department, but all departments, and also the cost allocation program. And the impact, looking at impact fees as well. Unfortunately, on the master fee end, they're not going to be done in time for budget development. So I think on our council agenda week after next, on the 14th, is continuation of the existing master fee schedule into probably August or September, at which time we'll have the new data and we'll adjust the new master fees accordingly, depending on what those numbers show and what council does with it. Any questions so far? So I can take a breath. Gene?
On the master fee schedule, do we advise the council whether we agree with that revised fee schedule or not?
We, as in the Harbor Advisory Board?
Yes.
We have not traditionally, no.
Okay.
Mark? To clarify, is funded depreciation an element of the operating budget at all?
Funded depreciation?
Yeah.
Yes and no. Finance does have a number of, if we, to, so the city has been in recent years working on funded depreciation and both vehicle and equipment replacement and building and other facility replacement. I had a number plugged into my budget when it came from finance. Unfortunately, when it came down to doing all my regular revenues and expenses, that one had to drop off the edge of the page because there was not enough money for funded replacement. That's obviously one of our big challenges, is all of our equipment and infrastructure. So while yes, it's on the radar screen, and there's numbers out there, and there's known quantities out there what the funded depreciation should be, or the funded replacement should be, the dollars to back it up aren't there, at least with my budget.
Is it noted as an accounting note in your budget presentation so that council understands that there is such a thing and that it's not included because it would not allow you to do a balance to submit a balanced budget?
I don't know the answer to that question yet, if that's the finance director's intent to move that forward. I'm sure it's going to be part of the discussion there somewhere, whether or not there'll be a numbered line item in the actual presentations or during the workshops, I couldn't tell you.
But the finance director, and as it relates to the Harbor Department's budget, is it not correct that the finance director would have to get that number from you as it relates to the Harbor Department?
Yes.
And is it your intention to provide the finance director with that number?
I think he already does have it.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I have a question. I don't know if you're going to be going on through all this, because I know you guys did this last month.
No, we're going to go through it.
Oh, okay. Then I'll wait.
Yeah. No, I will. And I will. I should have put a disclaimer in the beginning here. There's a lot of numbers floating through the staff report, some that I put in my staff report, some in the attachment, the draft, harbor operating equipment and accumulation fund documents. Those are what's going to be going to council and end up going into the budget. They're all still in, all this is still in development. Some of my numbers have already changed as I've changed, made requested changes to finance, and as new information has come to light, we've done some little bit of tweaking. So, you know, if it comes to pass that if I show a $40,900 item here and it actually isn't $40,900 by the time it gets to the budget, don't shoot me. This thing's still all in draft form and fungible and changing. So again, we've got we have three basic budgets. We've got an operating fund, which is our day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year operations. That is keeping the lights on and keeping the people employed and performing rescues and fixing things and towing boats and all that other good stuff, maintaining facilities. There's the equipment replacement fund. That's the big stuff, boats, and buildings would live in there. Or not, I wouldn't think so, but equipment replacement fund and accumulation fund, which is really sort of our war chest, that we, our piggy bank, our savings bank, that extra funding, extra leftover money at the end of the year, revenues over expenses, because we are an enterprise fund, and we, while most funds in the city, most fees in the city, you basically are at a cost recovery point. You're generally not allowed to make a profit because cities aren't in the profit-making business. We're an enterprise fund. We're a little different. We do get to make a profit because our profit goes back into our facilities and doing improvements and making things better. So the accumulation fund is where that profit would go, if you want to call it a profit, and that's where we pull money from to do our major projects, whether that's slip replacements, boat replacements, whatever. So those are the three funds we'll be looking at a little bit more closely. For each section, we've got sort of an overview, key things we've done this year, things we want to do next year, and what the balances are. And then I'll go through some of the line-by-line items that we're submitting to the finance department. So on page 2 of the staff report, on the revenue section, our estimated revenues for next year are just over $2 million, $2,010,000. This is, and really what I've looked at, tried to keep most things to as sort of the major categories. In most cases, five figures or more, but some of them are a little lower, just so I didn't want to get into minutia of every little thing we get into. Category A comes from our leases and license agreement. This is where the vast majority of our revenue comes from, $1,600,000. $1,179,000 of that comes from our minimum or base rents, And license agreements being fish and game, rent some dock, some space at our T pier, Gaffco and Harbor Hut lease some space over across the street for the trash cans, Surfline for their surf cams. There's little license agreements that are like sort of mini leases. So 1,600,000 of that, 606 is those leases, the lease base rents, the vast majority of our revenue. About 427,000 of that is our percent gross rents. That rent, again, I derive from increasing 17-18, FY 17-18's known number that we got in fiscal year 17-18 and increasing it by a very conservative 1%. Hopefully we'll do a little bit better than that, but as in most cases, budget, we get very conservative with these numbers because if we overestimate and say we're going to generate more revenue than what really happens and we budget expenses against it, and we don't make that money, we've got a problem, and we don't want to be doing that. So leases are where most of our rents come from. Category B, our next largest item, comes from our slip rental fees, from our commercial fishing slips. Those are both from our permanent slip holder fees, or fishermen that are there year-round, and when they go out, we rent their slips out on a temporary basis, on a transient basis, to whoever needs them. A lot of times that's commercial fishermen that are coming in seasonally. A lot of times that's sailboaters wanting a slip to put their boat for a month to do some work, and a lot of times it's just seasonal folks coming through. So $108,000 of that comes from our slip rentals. $99,500 comes from our mooring rentals. That is both the moorings that we own. We own about 10 of the permanent moorings out there in the bay, and the rest are all on leaseholds. Two of those leaseholds are Actually, 50 of those moorings are on leases, not on standard mooring fees. One is with the Morro Bay Yacht Club. They lease 25, and Morro Bay Marina leases another 25, a block 25, and that's in the lease revenues. So that $99,500 is just from the mooring owners, the folks that own the block and tackle and rent a plot of mud from us to put their moorings. And I misspoke on the item B. $108,000, that's from our commercial fishing slips only. $40,900, that's our transient slip rentals. That's the number that when we rent those slips out to transient folks. So a total of about $150,000 total comes from our slip rentals. $30,000 from our launch ramp parking fees. That's our $5 a day launch ramp fee, and including our What's the annual? $115, our annual pass rate, and $115. About $27,000 from the North T Pier tie-up and electrical service. About $26,200 from our South T Pier tie-up and electrical service. So roughly $55,000 from our two T Piers and the electrical service fees we charge there. About $26,700 from quote-unquote other harbor services. Those are our cone-operated showers, South T Pier hoist, the rinse down station, kind of our catch-all for all the oddball stuff. I think even the folks that unload kelp at the pier from the kelp cutting, that's kind of a catch-all. Those numbers go into there. $20,000 in this budget is from a to-be-applied-for boating and waterways derelict vessel demolition grant. That's our grant program where we haul up derelict boats out the launch ramp and cut them up. Yeah, we've applied for that. But as I wrote this, it was to be applied for. $9,000 in liveaboard service fees. $8,000 in a cable grant that we will be applying for to the cable committee for the Washington, D.C. trip that we've been pretty successful in getting every year. Cable committee has been great about giving us money for that. $3,000 from sort of a miscellaneous revenues. Boating and Waterways, Department of Boating and Waterways reimburses us for some of our training costs. We do auctions and make a few $100 in auctions here and there and salvage metal here and there, so it's kind of a catch-all for the strange oddball stuff. About $2,000 from special event reimbursement, so things like the Morro Bay Triathlon and other events that require our safety and other services to help those events. We charge them for our time in those. About $1,400 from the Anchorage. And anchorage fees, the north end of the moorings is our anchorage that's not a permanent anchorage, it's a transient anchorage. First 5 days there are free, and then it's a pretty nominal fee thereafter, and so those are folks that come through and want to anchor and get charged that fee, and then about $1,200 in late payment penalties for folks that don't pay their bills on time. They pay a penalty for that. Anything on the revenue front? That is the inspection and the permit fee and the service fee that we charge for trash and water and those sorts of impacts.
Thank you.
Yep.
How many liveaboards do we have right now, roughly?
Roughly, probably about 30 to 35 permitted, and probably another 8 to 10 not permitted.
How many of them are on moorings or slips that are yours, the department?
Well, most of them are on moorings. The majority of them have always been on moorings. Not that many slip holder little boards.
And those are... rented by you guys? Or?
The more they're all over the place. Some of them, I mean, Lynn's on a Morbay Yacht Club mooring. There's some on Marina Square. There's some that own their own moorings. Some okay. that rent moorings from others.
And the services that they get as far as the bathrooms, that's available to all of them, irregardless of if they're on your
yes.
slip or mooring?
Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions on revenues?
Yeah. So you guys don't get revenue from the lifeguard program?
No, they don't make any money. We actually, there's a small element of lifeguards that'll go into special event reimbursement because sometimes we farm out our lifeguards to some of these events that we require them to have lifeguards, and if they can't come up with their own, sometimes we provide them. So, yeah, they make a little revenue, but not much.
Oh, I was thinking about the Junior Lifeguard Program. And
junior
so
Parks
lifeguard. And Recs has that.
Parks and Recs has that.
So they pay the lifeguards, or they pay you for the lifeguards, or how does that work?
They are hopefully going to start paying this year. So they don't. They do their own lifeguarding services. We don't provide them any lifeguard services. Their personnel go through the Lifeguard Training Academy and are USLA, United States Lifesaving Association, certified. So they take care of their own life-saving needs. We provide them several days of instruction and assistance where we do operations with them with our jet skis and do some boat op days. And those costs that we incur, we are intending to charge the rec program for that this year.
Okay, well, that clarifies it. I thought all of those lifeguards were through you guys, but they're
no,
through
we,
them. Okay,
we,
that makes sense.
And the Lifeguard Academy is jointly put on by us and REC. They supply a good amount of personnel and training and assistance with us putting on the academy. In exchange for that, we all work together and train collectively our lifeguards and their junior lifeguard staff as well.
Gene?
Any more?
Eric, on the city occupancy tax, people who stay in motels on the west side of the Embarcadero, do we collect part of that occupancy tax?
We do not collect any transient occupancy tax. We do not collect any sales tax. We do not collect any the T-bid assessment that's collected on the waterfront.
Or possessory interest tax.
I think we should.
We've talked about that in the past.
Well, yeah, the board,
the last time we discussed that, Gene, the board was a unanimous agreement with you, and we took it up on the hill, and it wasn't enthusiastic. The concept was not enthusiastically received.
But isn't that a tax generated in the title and trust area?
No question. No question.
I just think that...
The opposite side of the coin, as has been discussed by the harbor director and other city personnel, is that, well, let's see, if you got some of that, then I guess we'd have to increase your allocation for various and sundry general fund services.
I can talk about the lease policy update that we're doing. One of the things that we're looking at fair market with the percentages is what are people charging for hotels in those different areas too. So currently I think it's what 5% is what we're working with, and with all the other things that are going on with Coastal Commission and low cost affordability with transient occupancy, there's that as well. But we will be just talking about it, and there, I have noticed while we've been doing this research that you know, that varies, you know, between the 0, 3, 5, 10, and so even though we might not get part of the T-bid, we'll get them here, and then once they're here, we'll have some of that.
Other questions?
I'm sorry, Eric. Could you tell me again how many moorings, total moorings you have?
There's 125 moorings in the bay.
Okay.
Yacht Club has 25 of those. Morro Bay Marina has 25 of those, or maybe Yacht Club has 26. I can never remember. And the rest, the other 75 are all privately owned.
Yeah. And Associated Pacific, don't they have a mooring field?
No, they don't have a mooring field. They just own 10 moorings. They don't have a field. They just own 10 individual moorings. They're okay. Like you owning 10 moorings. They just okay. They just happen to own 10.
Thank you.
Okay, please.
Okay, expenses. Ready to move on to expenses?
Yes.
Total budgeted expenses, $1,985,000. You notice that's a little bit less than revenues. Yay. Not by a lot. But our estimated revenues over expenses are a little bit above. So hopefully that will be a conservative estimate, and we'll see how that turns out. So that would be the scenario if that does come to pass. Those extra revenues would go into our accumulation fund, assuming they're not programmed somewhere else during the budget process. Those revenues would go into our accumulation fund, into the piggy bank, to go fund other stuff. So of that $1,985,000, about $998,000 of it is personnel services. That's people. It's our full-time staff to the tune of about $502,000 in full-time pay, about $176,000 in employer-paid benefits. That's for both full-time and part-time personnel. Our part-time personnel, there is a a system called PARS, the Public Agency Retirement System. A small amount of retirement money goes aside for the part-time folks, and there's a little bit of benefits for the part-time folks as well that gets accrued. So that's where that $176,000 goes. $95,000 in PERS unfunded accrued liability. That is the sort of the catch-up money that we're trying to get with PERS, that PERS has said we need to pay for all the years that we went. When PERS had very healthy and unrealistically optimistic revenue generation outlooks, and folks, agencies like us, didn't pay into the system because they thought the investments were going to do so darn good, and they didn't. Then the economic crash happened, and so that unfunded liability is a number we're paying back. To pay for those mistakes of the past, to get everything caught back up, to make sure that everything's fully funded.
That's a great system. You know, my stockbroker gives me advice, and I take my advice, and I'd lose, and he wants me to pay him to a cost. That's a system, boy. I love that one. Sorry, that's an unsolicited editorial comment. So.
$94,000 in pension normal costs. That's the regular pension fund stuff. So this year's been split out. In years past, it's just been one lump sum for benefits. So this year, they've got it split out, $176,500 in employer-paid benefits. So that's medical, health. I guess medical and health are the same thing. Vision, whatever the other benefits are, car allowance, all that kind of stuff. That's the employer-paid benefits. And then the pension normal cost is just the normal pension cost to PERS system. About $87,007 in part-time pay, and that goes to our reserve harbor patrol personnel, our maintenance aide, and our administrative assistant. As you probably know, last year our administrative technician moved on up to the rec department, and we opted not to fill that position, and we've got a part-time position in there now, Sherry Charette, who came down from REC. So those are those three positions at about 87,700. And then our lifeguard program is in another line item that I'll get to here in a minute. Turning the page, about $21,500 in other pay. That's vacation payouts and some other miscellaneous items. Usually that's an estimated number. Typically we don't end up spending all that because those people take their vacations and those other items don't usually come to fruition. $15,500 in night duty standby pay, so every night there's a Harbor Patrol officer on call and that person gets paid for being on call overnight. So that costs about $15,500 over the course of the year, and about $5,000 in overtime pay. There's not a lot of overtime costs we have. We do incur overtime. However, the majority of our personnel historically have banked that as comp time, meaning they bank it as time off, so they'll just take time off as opposed to being paid for it. Any questions on any of those before I move to the next category? Lynn?
Unfunded accrued liability, is that a fixed amount for each year, or is that variable? Can they increase it when they feel like it?
Or is it a one-time?
It's not a one-time. And I don't have the answer to when it ends, but it's not forever. It's a few years' worth, and I think we're into the second or third year maybe of it. That number is similar to last year's, but not identical, so it changes a little bit, but... that's not from here on out forevermore. That will end hopefully soon.
But for the foreseeable future, you know, to your recollection.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how many years there are left on it.
Probably depends on how good their stockbroker is.
Okay, on to supplies. Supplies are the stuff we use to make our operation go. $65,000 in supplies. Lots of little categories in there. Our two major categories there are $25,000 in fuel. That's the gas to drive our Harbor Patrol boats around and vehicles. And about $18,000 in machinery and equipment supplies. That's all the little stuff we buy to keep the boats running and vehicles running that we do in-house. So not a ton of money in supplies, but it's an important item. And then down into the next item, big ticket item services. Those are the things we get from outside. About $400,000 in services. $57,000 of that roughly is legal services. Our legal number is divided into two categories. The first is, so A&W Allisher and can never pronounce their last name, Winmer. They're our legal firm that we contract with. There's a set contract amount that they cost per year, and we pay 20% of that. The other two enterprise funds pay 20% each for 60, and the general fund pays 40%. That item is in our cost allocation number, the 300 and some odd thousand, 306,000 in our cost allocation program. The 56,900 you see here is in all the other stuff that we use A&W for specific to the harbor. So when they bill out for their items individually, when they're working on specific harbor projects, that's not part of their overall services to the city. That's 56,900.
Is there participation in lease review and negotiations included in that 57?
Yep, that's where a big part of it is. $55,000 trash and hazardous waste disposal. Most of that is to Morbid Garbage for their standard trash service. We get rid of a little bit of hazmat here and there as part of our waste recycling program, and also when we destroy derelict boats, we get a little bit of hazmat out of those, so that's where that number goes. $50,000 in outside equipment repair, that's primarily our boat repair number. We don't always spend that much, but we put a pretty big number in there because one engine failure will eat that up in a hurry, so we'd like to be able to budget at least for some major catastrophe. Knock on wood, hopefully don't have those. $43,000 in water. That's just our cost of water. That's for our slips, our office, our piers, irrigation. That's our water bill. $42,000 in general liability insurance, standard insurance there. $30,000 in contractual services, and $20,000 of that is the DBOG grant. So that's just the expense related to that revenue item. So about $10,000 in miscellaneous contractual services, surveying, appraisals, those sorts of things, property appraisals. $25,000 in electricity, about $24,000, almost $25,000 in property damage insurance. So total insurance close to $70,000. $10,005 in meetings and conferences, $8,000 of which of that is the grant from the cable committee for the DC trip. So the rest of those are other meetings and conferences that we send our folks to. And then $10,000 in consulting and services. Actually, that's where our audits and appraisals and those things go. Contractual services are usually maintenance, small maintenance projects that we need to get done. We'll do contractual services for that. Any questions on those, on services? Gene?
You know, in our own house, we put up solar panels last summer. Cost us about, $10,000. And we haven't paid a nickel in electricity since then. Is there any way we can think about doing solar panels somewhere with the city?
Yeah. We could.
I mean, we expect to be paid back within 4 or 5 years. So that's a good return.
Yeah. So it would be considered for not a revenue generator per se, but sort of a reverse revenue generator. Yeah. Expense reducers.
Anything else?
Yeah. As far as audits and appraisals, what was it last year, or do you have a estimate?
Our appraisals, we generally have 3 to 6 appraisals a year. They're anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 generally for appraisals. Audits, the last time we did audits, whole cloth, it was, I want to say, $50,000 worth of 3 years worth of audits. We're not proposing to do that degree of auditing this year. The lease management update process, one of the goals of that is to come up with an auditing, I call it a scheme, but an auditing format and way that we're going to go about auditing in the past. In years past, about every 5 years, we've done lease site audits and done some number of leases, not all of them on the waterfront. When Laurie and I did our last one back in 2014 or 15, we took on all of the leases, and it was just way too much. So out of the lease management policy update process, we're hopefully going to develop, or do intend to develop, an auditing policy and a way to go about auditing into the future.
Okay, so of that $10,000, how much is set aside for the auditing?
I don't know. Let me see if I can answer that for you. My big blue folder. Until we put our lease policy in place, we're not going to be doing a big, robust auditing program. Oh, I don't have that broken down. Couldn't tell you. Sorry. I think we've got close to 3,000 in appraisals. Surveys, that's for property surveying. I probably got one of those projects coming, and those aren't terribly expensive, so fair amount. Any other questions on those?
Okay.
D.
Okay. Item D, $135,000 in debt service. That's the South T Pier loan repayment. I think we're down to 3 or 4 years on that. So that's going to be our biggest relief, financial relief in the near term, is that loan going away. Item E, about $65,000 for a beach lifeguard program. That's for personnel and services and supplies and everything that they cost. So, again, they generate a little bit of revenue, but not a lot. And then $306,600 in the cost allocation program, which is pretty close to what it is this year. I think we're within a few thousand dollars of what it is in this year's budget. So although the cost allocation study is still being generated, that's where we are with it right now. Hopefully, knock on wood, that won't change drastically to the larger end. If it goes anywhere, hopefully it gets smaller, but somehow I doubt that will happen. So any questions on those? So again, we estimate our expenses. We look back and try and get a good handle on what we're spending in the current year and in the past couple of years. Looking at all those different items, absent any significant program, service, or initiatives or personnel changes, meaning we're going to stop harbor patrolling, you know, 3 days a week or doing anything crazy, big, and different. Really, there's those expenses are fairly well fixed. There's not a lot of room to play with, and I estimate somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000 of our total department costs are really discretionary. And if I had to cut, you know, if I was asked to, hey, industry, you need to cut $30,000 out of your budget, that's the first place I'd go, would be those sort of discretionary things that really wouldn't have any effect on our programs or services or initiatives. They're just the things that could be redirected if absolutely necessary. And there's, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 of that is in supplies and $15,000 to $20,000 of that is in services. So, you know, sort of the bottom line of that is there's not a lot of room to play with.
Which catches up with you over time?
Which one?
Which would catch up with the department.
Oh, yes. It would eventually catch up with the overtime because that means you're not spending on something. We've always prided ourselves on being a very frugal department. We're very tight with our money, as you know. We don't just spend money willy-nilly, and we think we do a pretty good job at spending the public's money and defending our money as best we can. There's not a lot of room to play with in there. Okay.
Okay.
On to capital. So our capital budget, proposed capital budget for the upcoming year, $250,000 carry-on of the DBW grant-funded launch ramp rehabilitation project for engineering and permitting. I actually was working most of my day today on the RFP for those engineering services, so hopefully we'll get that out fairly soon and start getting some proposals back and to move that project forward. That one has a grant deadline of next February, I believe, so we're on a mad scramble to get that one done. $40,000 for South T-Pier renovations. There's we did a South T-Pier engineering assessment a couple of years ago, and there are some findings out of that that we'd like to try and take care of in this budget year. North T-Pier, $10,000. We did an engineering assessment even further back than the South T-Pier one. There's still a couple things lingering out of that I'd like to take care of. Unfortunately, I don't have funding to take care of everything on both those piers lists, so we're dealing with it largely on an as-needed basis. So those are the two items on funding for the piers. $20,000 for the ice machine maintenance and repair, although that one may change as we go through budgeting. Kind of depends on, assuming everything goes good on the machine and getting all that equipment replaced, we're going to be talking with Race Engineering and Santa Monica Seafood and coming up and developing a maintenance program with Race to carry that machine into the future. The past maintenance on it up until the current leaseholders had been pretty haphazard and not real great. Santa Monica Seafood, over the last 5 years they've been there, have done a great job. And so we're hopefully get it, now we've got new equipment, get it on a little better maintenance schedule. So might be able to bring that number down a little bit. We'll see how that goes. And then $445,000 total for the Beach Street slips replacement project, based on funding that we had available in an accumulation fund. We spent about $75,000 in that project so far. What I carried forward was $215,000 from current year budget, and asking for $155,000 new. Add that to the $75,000 spent, and you come to $445,000. All that I'm proposing to replace in that slip project is the north set of those slips. We've got some newer cost estimations on that to build those out. And there is not money to do both sets, both north and south. I don't believe so. And maybe once we do our engineering, get our cost estimations, that may change, but that's what I'm proposing to budget in our capital project program. So if we completely spend all these, and again, the DBW grant, that's a pass-through, so that didn't really affect our accumulation fund. But if all these projects are completely spent, we've really depleted our accumulation fund down to four figures. There's not much left. If our revenues come in over expenses, we at least are projecting right now in the current fiscal year to maybe end with about $28,000 above revenues over expenses, but that's yet to be seen, so not a lot of room left to maneuver in there. Questions?
You mentioned that the Beach Street slips replacement, that 445 is not sufficient to do the, both the north and the south, correct?
Correct.
And would you say that they are similar state of repair?
No, the north slips are much older. We did a partial replacement on the south slips in about 1997, 98, 99, somewhere through there. We replaced some of the fingers in there and did some structural repairs because they were in pretty bad shape. So we kind of gave them another quarter life, so to speak. The north slips haven't been touched other than just doing patching things together to keep them together.
The south side of the south slips have always had some problems down there.
Yeah. The we had a couple boat crashes in there in the last set of fingers in there that did a fairly significant amount of damage in there, yeah.
How long would you estimate before it becomes a significant safety concern for public access on those?
That's a loaded question. if safety concerns become an issue, we're going to address them as they become an issue. We're not going to let them go to a and just let a safety issue ride. We'll fix what we need to fix. They are old. They are deteriorated. They're way past their useful life, at least on the north end. The south end is doing a little better, but not much. They're at their useful life. They need to be replaced now.
Am I correct in thinking that the 445 for the Beach Street slips is not included in the current projected harbor infrastructure unfunded liability? My recollection is that it is not. Well,
I think at
one point in time, 3 years ago, for sure, it was 3 years ago, no question. And then the department began to contemplate funding it from the accumulation fund.
I think it's included in the overall liabilities bottom line. In other words, here's the number that we estimate we should be spending to keep all this stuff maintained and fixed and replaced. It's included in that number. It will pull $445,000 off of that bottom line once completed. Right now, I mean, I guess it's funded now, at least partially funded.
So in my simple mind, it's therefore not included in unfunded liability.
I know that on our current spreadsheets, it still exists on our current spreadsheet and factors into the bottom line numbers. Haven't pulled it off. Yeah, technically, I guess, assuming the council approves it, we should be pulling it off. Although, with the existing numbers that we had approved already, it probably should be pulled off from an unfunded standpoint, but it's not going to make a giant dent in the bottom line number.
Well, the reason that's important to me is because the Harbor Advisory Board keeps talking to the City Council, to whom it serves, about the nature, the scope, and the extent of the unfunded liability that relates to harbor infrastructure repair, maintenance, and replacement. So that's why I asked. But we can resolve it later.
Yeah, I don't. It certainly doesn't invalidate or say change. Even though $445,000 sounds like a lot of money, when you look at the overall bottom line for all the unfunded liabilities, it doesn't change the narrative, nor does it make a huge dent in the bottom line to change that narrative, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's still a very large unfunded liability, even if we get this spent and get this project done. Yeah, it takes that one off, but there's a bunch more that are still looming.
Okay, anything else? You want to conclude?
So again, the South T-Pier loan is going to be a big help. Loss of the Dynegy power plant revenue, $275,000 a year back in about 2014, was a big hit. We've recovered from that, but just barely. We got a modest positive revenue balance, but it's not enough to deal with the big ticket items. When I inherited this position, which was shortly after the revenue fall, we did a couple pretty big projects, one in the South T Pier and a Harbortrol boat replacement. We probably had close to $1 million in the bank in accumulation fund at that time, and I've pretty much burned it all. So trying to get some of this stuff done. The attachment one is, again, what's going to
Hang on a sec. So summarize the attachment for us, and then I think what we'll do, if it's okay with the board, is we'll poll the board and see if they have any questions about the attachments. And if we do, we do. And if we don't, we'll move on. But this is, speaking for the board, I want to say this is an extremely well-prepared agenda item. And our thanks and gratitude for the department for taking the time and the effort to do this.
Yeah, thank you. I guess sort of the bottom line is, without a major change in our service model that would cut expenses, depending on what the master fee study comes up with, that's yet to be seen. Without any new revenue streams or new economic development, we're looking pretty flat. Like I say, the South T Pier loan is going to give us $135,000 of relief, and that'll be pretty significant. So I would imagine that what we ought to be doing, thinking towards of that $135,000, is start programming that towards capital projects. We're balanced on the operating budget, but we need to start getting some of our capital backlog done, and that'll help, but it's going to take time to build that war chest up. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. So any questions from the board on the attachments? Then I'll just go in order. Charisse.
Okay. Thanks. On 37, page 37 with the enterprise fund on expenditures.
H37?
Yeah,
H37. So you're looking at the attachment one, just for those out in TV land. It's not... I guess we don't number. I guess we
yeah, you start. Did. You labeled them.
We don't label our budgets like our agenda like the council does, where the whole agenda's got a numbering system. So yeah, page H37 of attachment one.
Okay, so it's a salaries and benefits, and just to see if it could possibly happen again, or to understand what these expenses were, the salaries and benefits between 2015 to 2016 increased significantly. Is there an understanding of what that was besides raises?
Then it jumps back down in 17-18.
Right, yeah. I'm just wondering what occurred then that could possibly occur in the future.
I don't know. Part of it could be some of the PERS, because you don't see, and like the report I gave you where I had the PERS funded, PERS unfunded, things kind of broken out. I'm assuming that all the PERS stuff is factored into there, some of the unfunded liability things, so it's probably an unfunded liability payout issue that happened 1 year and skipped a year maybe. Otherwise, we're pretty steady with those numbers. It may also be an accounting issue, because that's about the time It's a little earlier. We've got a new finance director who's doing things and accounting for things and adjusting with her way of doing it. And some of the items are just numbers shifting around because of accounting for things in different ways. But I don't have a definitive answer for that, why that one jumped up and down and back up again. Because okay. I don't see further down in those lines anything else where it maybe would have popped up somewhere else.
I also, Therese, did not have any definitive information or knowledge, but I can tell you from my review of another department's budgets at about that same time, my recollection, vague recollection, is that the city, that's when the PERS thing first hit,
okay.
And the city made a series of accounting adjustments as required by public accounting procedures or whatever, and the same blip occurred in another department.
Right. So for future, we don't see that in the forecast as far as jumping up that significantly.
Well, you'd have to talk to PERS about that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Well, there's what's known as the discount rate, which is what PERS estimates what kind of return they'll make on their money, and they're lowering that rate. They're being more conservative, and that a 0.5% change in that has a huge ripple effect down the line into the whole PERS system.
Okay, thanks.
Dana. Mark. Lynn.
Yes, in that same year, under revenues, fines, and forfeitures, 15, 16, 14, almost 15,000, then 16, 17, 9,000. Those are really big changes from year to year. And I'm wondering what would account for that. Anything in particular? Up to 1920, we've got 1,200 proposed. Estimated 23.
Yeah, which is... I don't know where that big number back in 15-16 would have come from, other than I'm assuming it's penalties. We don't really have any forfeitures. So it's probably penalties, which is listed as fines in here. Probably just a big year on a lot of late or non-payments. Mm-hmm.
Do I understand correctly that this particular schedule came from the finance department? Was it generated by the finance department, not by the Harbor Department?
Yes, and I probably should have included with my original disclaimer about this still being a work in progress. These finance charts do come from the finance department, so I am not the most nimble with them because their categorization is not always exactly equal with the categories I'm used to working with in my three budgets. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Jeremiah? Eric, on the department summary of personnel, can you share with us the impact, and non-specifically, I mean, not in terms of particular personnel, what's the impact on personnel costs from the tiers system?
Oh, boy.
I mean, as I understand it, there are four. Is that correct? Four categories? Do I understand that correctly?
There are four categories. There's the classic, meaning the original PERS folks that were on the original formulas before the major changes took place within
are
the PERS system.
Are they otherwise referred to as Tier 1?
Yeah, I guess Tier 1 or Classic, yes.
Okay.
Tier 2 was the first level of system revision. Tier 3 was the second level of revision, and then PEPRA is the fourth, which I don't know exactly what PEPRA stands for. I never remember.
Do you have Tier 4s in the department?
I do not have any Tier 4s.
You have 1, 2s, and 3s.
We have two Classics or Tier 1s. You asked me that earlier, and I wrote it down. two classics or tier ones, three tier twos, and one tier three. But I don't know I couldn't tell you if you had an existing person and they were a classic versus a tier two or a tier two versus a 2-3, I don't know what the number drop is between those.
Do you know what the in some numerical fashion what the difference is in the PERS obligation between a 2 and a 3, for instance? And that's a very inelegant question.
Not numerically. The difference in the tiers is in the retirement formula, and I'm going to make these numbers up. Don't hold me to these because I know I'm not going to be right with a number.
Well, that's good. Give us a hypothetical.
A hypothetical. Let's say a tier two is their formula is 2.7 at 55, meaning they get at 55 years of age they're eligible for 2.7 times their pay times their number of years. So if you had 10 years in, you multiply 2.7 times 10, and that's your formula, and you're eligible for that at 55 years old. So 2.7 at 55 may be a tier two person. The tier three person would maybe be 2.3 at 55 or 2.5 at 60 or something like that. It's a sort of a quote unquote lesser formula, a less I guess another way to put it, a less lucrative formula for the employee.
And less costly for the city.
Less money they get or less cost. And in all the PERS formulas, there's an employee contribution and an employer contribution. I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but the employee in years past, in the city of Morro Bay, the employer, meaning the city, picked up most, if not all, of the employee costs. Those days, I believe, are completely gone, and all employee groups are now picking up their employee costs, and the city picks up the employer costs. But I don't have any numbers what those would be. But that's basically what the difference between the tiers are, is it's different formulas.
Okay. And the equipment replacement, page H49 of attachment 1, replacement of the Sandspit emergency phone. You mentioned to me privately that the friends of the Harbor Department are collecting money toward that. What's the total approximate cost of that?
The total cost for that is going to be about $10,000.
Okay.
And they've gathered, from what I understand, about $7,000 of that already.
Okay.
So they're doing good. So that's one of the items that's still moving in my budget, in that I don't have to. I originally had budgeted the full $10,000 for that, so I'm adjusting.
Okay. And because it's here, speak to us briefly, please, about patrol boat number 68.
So patrol boat 68 is our oldest boat, built in 1984, up on Toro Creek Road somewhere. It is getting long in the tooth, and either needs a major refurbishment. Pillar Point just took their boat that was built, rather that was built in the 70s, and brought it down to Don's Yard in Santa Barbara and did the multiple $100,000 refurbishment and put it back into use. So it needs something either along those lines, a complete reglassing or reglass encapsulation or some sort of an engineered structural fix, or flat-out replacement. Replacement is probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, depending on to what degree of fire fighting preparedness we give it. When our newest boat, 6-4, when we rebuilt that, we put it to full class 3 fireboat standard, the lowest NFPA, National Fire Protection Association standard classification, and it cost us a little over $400,000 for that boat in its entirety. So depending on what we went with that, we estimate cost in replacing 6-8 is probably in today's dollars, probably somewhere between $450,000 and $500,000, depending on how crazy we got with specifications.
Do you have an opinion as to how much it costs to refit the vessel?
I have a guesstimation of somewhere between $200,000
to $300,000. Okay. And finally, I mean, at least as far as I'm concerned, finally, the page H50 is labeled accumulation fund, and there's some pretty one extremely important point, I think, in the first paragraph of the budget review, first sentence of the budget review paragraph, or I should say, yeah, the first sentence. It's a long sentence. So I'd like you to make that point to the public, if you'd be so kind.
Are you just talking about the accumulation fund page?
I am. Budget overview, first sentence.
Yeah, so...
You've already told us about the 372 that's gone.
Yeah, so it's the fund that we basically take major revenues out of to do our major equipment and capital project stuff. With what's in our current budget, we're going to be down, like to say, probably four digits or less if we spend all the funding. We have an estimated need over the next 10 years of about $500,000 per year, notwithstanding our discussion we had a little bit ago about the Beet Street slips pulling that down a little bit, but it's not going to pull it down by six figures by any means, but at least on an annual basis. So that fund is been bled down to its bare minimum. And that's what we're really going to rely on in the future to start building back up to do our major capital projects. We do get a little bit of grant funding here and there. You know, our patrol boat 6-4, we got two grants, one from Barton and Boating Waterways for some equipment, and the cable committee gave us generously funding to buy one of our diesel engines in that boat. So we'll still be able to look for grant funding. I'm sure we'll augment things with grant funding. But in general, our accumulation fund is... in need of some infusion of cash.
Well, you made that clear, but the point I want that I want to come out of this as a final point is that the harbor department, which knows better than anybody else what the infrastructure, where the harbor-related infrastructure needs are, is relative to repair, maintenance, and replacement, is projecting approximately $5 million over the next 10 years. Which, if we amortize it on an annualized basis, is $500,000 per year. And we're projecting no increase in revenue. In particular, the only relief that we see, marginal relief, is from South T-Pier debt service. And we have this PERS thing hanging over our head. Is that about it?
Yeah, that's about it. And just add insult to injury, that estimate over 10 years doesn't account for inflation. That's just today's dollar number.
Good.
I'm sure it's going to grow a little bit.
So in 2018?
Unless we have deflation.
So we're in, that'll happen, yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else on the board on this agenda item? Okay. Eric and Lord, the department, thanks to our department. Really, this is outstanding. Thank you for this. And we're going to take a comfort break for 5 minutes. Okay, we're back. Thank you. Thanks for your patience. And we're on agenda item B6, presentation of the status of working waterfront and Measure D recommendations that were made by the Harbor Advisory Board to the General Plan Advisory Committee. So, Eric, can you just briefly give us a... I apologize because I'm responsible primarily for why we're still sitting here, but lead us into this one, please.
Sure. So as we know, last year we made some recommendations to the General Plan Advisory Committee. That's the group that's citizen group that's advising the Planning Commission and City Council on the general plan and local coastal program update and all the associated documents that go along with that. 2017-18, I had an ad hoc committee of the Harbor Advisory Board that worked on that, developed some recommendations. They worked together with the Planning Commission, had a couple joint meetings to look at what the HAB's recommendations were, and we recommended a number of things to go forward into the general plan and local coastal program regarding working waterfronts and some language and zoning and other things, and then some other clarification efforts to try and clarify Measure D and some of the ambiguities in Measure D, at least what we perceive to be ambiguities in Measure D. So those two groups jointly made some recommendations to the GPLCP, and this item is an update to try and find out where they are in that process. The GPLCP process is moving along pretty darn well. I was actually on the website the last couple days because we have to do a sea level rise assessment for the State Lands Commission because we're Tidelands Trust owners, and a lot of that work has already been done in the GPLCP process update, and there's a lot of documentation. A lot of stuff's been done already. It's on the Plan Morro Bay website for the city. So I referenced that in the staff report to try and find out where we were on everything. I did some searches. Working waterfront is peppered throughout the documents in many locations. The most significant element that we moved forward into that process that lives in one of those documents, and I believe it's the Plan Morro Bay document, was the three areas that we wanted to classify the waterfront of the commercial recreational fishing, Measure D zone, the core section of the waterfront, and then the water-only lease section at the south end. There's a number of implementing actions that went along with that document, the LU4678, the numbers that I put in my staff report, that inform various land use policies and talk about working waterfronts and some of the things we're trying to achieve. There's also a fair amount of working waterfront related language in the zoning code update, because part of this process we're updating the zoning code, so some of it lives in the zoning code. And then the districts are mentioned in the zoning code update. That's where the three districts that we move forward, they live in the zoning code update. And then from what I've determined, or what seems to be the case, is that a lot of our work regarding the Measure D part and the working waterfront part would necessarily live in the waterfront master plan update, which is still yet to be done. It's one of the follow-on documents that will be updated. It's recommended as being part of the follow-on documents to be updated. Out of the GPLCP update. So I think a fair amount of it would and could live there, because the implementation language, there's a document that deals with implementation and policy language, and that's in the Waterfront Master Plan, and that's yet to be created. So I think a fair amount of our work would necessarily live in those documents. But in terms of the existing documents, it's really mostly the three zones and then ample reference to working waterfronts and preserving working waterfronts and implementing things that can help working waterfronts. But as far as the recommendations we made, the kind of go back on those, the things we made is the Joint Planning Commission and Harbor Advisory Board regarding Measure D. We made some clarification recommendations for what does, quote, primarily for the purposes of mean when it comes to commercial and recreational fishing. We made some recommendations for that. You made some recommendations on what does, quote, unquote, clearly incidental thereto mean with regard to commercial and recreational fishing. And then we made some recommendations in regard to what does, quote, unquote, non-commercial recreational fishing mean. In other words, what is non-commercial recreational fishing? So those are the three things that we recommended as a joint group to go into the general plan local coastal program update. And then regarding working waterfront, we had our mission statement. The group ended up moving forward, and I think it was largely Planning Commission because of the Harbor Advisory Board, as we know. We had that list of uses, land uses, that we basically listed every possible use under the sun that could occur on the waterfront. As a Harbor Advisory Board, Planning Commission didn't forward that. They didn't like that. So the overall group, we didn't move that forward to the General Plan Local Coastal Program. They believe that list was a little too long and far-reaching. But they supported the mission statement. They supported the three sectors of the three areas, again, the called the fishery sector, which was Measure D, the visitor sector, Beach Street to Mariners Park, which is a little park right by Associated Pacific. Really should be Tidings Park. And then the commercial sector from Mariners Park South or from Tidings Park South, which is really the water-only area at the south end of the bay. And then we also recommended that the update should include the mission statement identification of those three sectors. So those are the things we move forward. I think some of the documents are still a work in progress, but there's a lot of documents as part of this GPLCP update that this language does live currently now and can possibly live in the future.
Thanks. So, Board, this is, in a very real sense, the maybe our last or one of our last bites of the apple on this. So I'm presuming that we've studied the attachments. Eric did a fine job. The Harbor Department did a fine job of extracting out of these three voluminous documents, the most pertinent pages. And do we have questions or comments? And if, in fact, we have something that we think is substantive that we do not find in the draft updates, then we will send a memorandum to council to that effect. Gene?
I'm just curious how we go ahead with the waterfront master plan at this point.
Say that again, please.
I'm curious how we go ahead on following up on the waterfront master plan and what vehicle that entails.
Presumably, that's a question that we're going to have to ask the community development director. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Gene, if you could be so kind as to send me an email, that would be really great. And I'll draft something. Jeremiah? No. Lynn?
No.
Mark? Okay, Dana? Charisse? Okay. So the board will note, if you take a look at attachment 1, page 326, or I guess it's page 38, up in the upper left-hand corner, that the three sectors, the sector that we designated or we recommended to be the commercial sector, that's from Mariners Park South to the State Park, has been relabeled by the LCPGP update process as the southern sector. I'm not making a point. I don't have a problem with it. I'm just making a point that it's happened. The sentence below that says, uses allowed in the Measure D zone and associated definitions have also been clarified and are included in the zoning code LIP. One of the definitions that we struggled with and the Planning Commission struggled with was the clearly incidental thereto language. And I see reference to that in these three documents, but I don't see any clarification of what that means. Did I miss something?
Not, I didn't find anything more.
Okay.
It's a goal already.
So, and I think one of your documents in here makes mention of that. If you go to attachment 2.
Policy LU 4.2, Measure D uses.
There you go.
Yeah. So one of the goals is apparently one of the, but I'm a little confused as to why it's a policy. I mean, does that mean
in the context of this process, if something is a policy, does that mean it's actually going to happen before the plan is finalized, as opposed to it being a, quote, goal, unquote?
Don't know the exact answer to that.
That's okay. We're going to ask. We're going to ask.
I believe the way this document will work is policy. It will be an adopted policy as part of this land use document. Policy LU 4.2 will be to clarify the meaning of Measure D and clarity incidental thereto. Meaning... we're not doing it right here and now, but it's our policy to look at that and clarify that, even though we've made recommendations in that regard. It would be my belief that that clarification would live, again, in the waterfront master plan, because in the draft zoning code interpretation provisions document, and that's with capital letters, that's an actual document name, the zoning code interpretation provisions document, that's where I went thinking, okay, that's where I'm going to find clarification of Measure D, because it's an interpretation thing. And it basically says that regarding the waterfront stuff, the waterfront master plan is where those interpretations are going to live, and we're doing that in the future, according to the document.
Which brings us to Gene's point.
Yeah.
So we just kick the can down the road for a while?
Good question. Let's find out. Let's find out. You send me your email, we'll find out. Well, to the extent that we can. So page 38 of that same document, policy LU 4.8, Maritime Support Services, continue to promote, this is a quote, continue to promote the viability of maritime support services presently operating on Beach Street. That one kind of confused me. What maritime support services exist on Beach Street? Yeah. Say it again. They consider that to be the street?
I don't know what. I was wondering too. And that's why they had come up with it. Otherwise, there isn't.
True enough.
Well, I mean,
there used to be.
Yes, true.
On Beach Street. I mean, if you read it literally, on Beach Street. There's nothing on Beach Street. I mean, there used to be the old refrigeration place at the top of the hill,
right,
where that big fishing lure building thing is.
Yeah.
I would read that to be the base of Beach Street, and it probably means the fuel dock and the commercial fishing activity.
If I remember right, that area is zoned commercial fishing support or something like that.
That's true.
It's zoning.
The Beach Street special plan.
Yes.
Right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. So I think this is holdover language would be my guess, but we're going to find out. Policy LU 5.1, same page, use conflicts. Quote, reduce potential conflicts between commercial fishing and coastal recreation uses. Are there conflicts?
Sorry, point me to where you're
same
at.
Same page. Page 3.8 of Plan Morro Bay, public
okay.
Draft, May 2018, policy LU 5.1, use conflicts.
Okay, I see where you're at. I wasn't sure where you were.
And I'm not suggesting anybody here would necessarily know the answer to the question, but, I mean, we have a policy that we're going to reduce potential conflicts. Well, what conflicts?
Jeremiah, what are you in conflict with?
Y'all get along pretty good as far as I know.
All right, well, we'll ask. Dana?
Here somewhere, I was looking it up. The recreational uses that they have are all about commercial, the kayak rentals, the electric boat rentals. They never said anything about the existing recreational vessels, I call it sailboats or mooring. So the way it was presented was those business or those visitors in those vessels.
Well, the master goal for LU5, of which these policies, as Eric tried to explain to me, these policies are supposed to illuminate the goal, apparently, right, says coastal priority uses are viable, protected, and contribute to the economy and character of Morro Bay. Doesn't diminish my question about what these potential conflicts are. So I guess we'll ask. On attachment number 4, page 30, item number 2, permitted uses. This is land use regulations, and this is the commercial fishing district topic. It says, fishing, nature, observation, and access to water uses in accordance with the provisions of Title 15 Harbor and Ocean Regulations of the Morro Bay Muni Code. I'm sorry, I actually should have circled number B. Existing uses may remain and be redeveloped in the same use, but shall not be expanded or enlarged. So my question about this, and it's a question I have that maybe can't be answered tonight, and probably can't be. This suggests to me some possible expansion of Measure D language. Because we are talking about the commercial fisheries district, which they say is the Measure D area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the Measure D area. It's one and the same. CF district is the Measure D zone.
It says fishing, nature, observation, and access to water uses in accordance with the provisions of Title 15 Harbor and Ocean Regulations of the Morro Bay Muni Code. Eric, have you ever had an opportunity to think about Measure D, the Measure D area, as it relates to Title 15, which I did, embarrassed to say I did not look up and read before I came here tonight?
Well, Title 15 is the chapter of the Morro Bay Municipal Code that has all the harbor stuff, from speed limits to the liveaboard ordinance to pier use stuff. I mean, that's all the harbor stuff. That's our chapter.
And have you ever tripped across something that you thought, how can we do or not do that when we're in the Measure D area?
No, this is an odd. Fishing, nature, observation, and access to water uses in accordance with the provision of Title 15. As the following uses are permitted in the CF district.
Okay.
And you look at the zoning for the CF district for the commercial fishing, Measure D district, really is Measure D in the language of Measure D. It's another good question.
Okay.
I don't know what that is.
In the next page, which is 31, we're still in the zoning code update, Module 3, use regulations. Way up at the top at sub-item F, moorage in inclement weather. Why just inclement weather? It would seem to exclude other moorage. This is the H district. That's the harbor district. That's our district, if you will. And it says permitted uses. F says moorage in inclement weather. So what about non-inclement weather, or do we have 125 non-conforming moorages? Okay. Where's John Lindsay when you need him?
Are you reading that moorage in the context of moorings?
Not just. I mean, well,
because I'm going up to C in that same item, in that
yes.
same list. Dockage and support facilities for licensed commercial fishing and recreational, including sport fishing boats.
Were you? Nobody, sorry.
C, go backwards, that same list. You're an F, go back to C in that same list.
C is scuba diving and windsurfing in areas designated by the city council.
Oh, I'm going backwards the wrong direction, sorry.
So we're in the Harbor District, that's the H District, which they designated
okay.
as being the Harbor District, and we're on permitted uses.
Okay, I was going the wrong direction on
that's
the page,
okay.
sorry.
That's all, no, it's okay.
Scuba diving and windsurfing.
So I guess we have a memo question. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, you have commercial and recreational boating and fishing. That's a very general catch-all. It doesn't really address tie up, moorage, dockage, whatever you want to call it. I guess my question would be, does A incorporate all various types of boat tie-up that isn't on a mooring? And is F just talking about moorings and why inclement weather? Or is that sort of trying to make a harbor of safe refuge statement? It's odd. We could ask what that means.
Okay, and then the next page, which is 32, we have a new district, C, the waterfront district. But I don't see, and maybe it's somewhere else in some other document, I don't see a geographic designation for this district.
There's the zoning map that has all of these. It has the H district, it has the WF district, it has the CF district.
Oh.
It's a color-coded thing.
That's a part of this.
Yes. Yeah,
I didn't attach it. No, that's okay.
Include it, but yeah, it is. Somewhere buried in that zoning document is the picture.
Okay, thank you.
Lots of colors.
Thank you. Moving on to attachment 5, page 34, item B3. The end of the second sentence says, or a harbor master development plan. The topic is maintenance, dredging, mitigation measures. Does the city code define and identify a, quote, harbor master, unquote?
Yeah, that's my retirement plan. I believe the municipal code as it currently stands identifies the harbor director. My job description describes me as a harbor director / harbor master.
Mm.
But that's another curious entry. Harbor master development plan.
Okay. So apparently, this is a rhetorical statement, actually, or question. So apparently, we have an incomplete, at minimum, an incomplete description of this entity.
Yeah. Basically, it's saying channels, turning bases, and anchorages shall be limited to those that exist or authorized under Title 15, which, again, that's just our municipal code that deals with the harbor that doesn't really talk about.
It says you've got a development plan, buddy.
Apparently I do.
Do you have a development plan as defined in
this? If I don't, I'm going to get one.
I mean, we are talking about the zoning code update here.
I'm curious where that came from.
Chapter 17.09, Waterfront and Harbor Area Districts.
I can only surmise maybe it came from some of our existing old documents that probably mention a harbor master development plan.
Sure. I'm confident you're correct about that. So.
But I'm going to have one. I'm going to make one.
As a position or an individual, would that not be one word rather than two? And thus, this means a master development plan for the harbor? Harbor being an adjective for a master development plan?
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
It should be.
No, I'm getting a very appropriate English lesson from Lynn.
True, but if you were talking about the...
But I could read it the other way. But you're quite correct. It could also be read that way. So we have we'll...
You've got a master development plan.
I think you've got it. It's a harbor master development plan. It's a master development plan for the harbor.
Thank you, Lynn.
That's what it's trying to say.
Thank you, Lynn. So, can't even hardly parse that.
Whoever wrote this apparently doesn't know what a harbor master is.
banned language. Okay, good. All right, that's great. Thank
there
you.
There goes my plan.
That's great. Sorry. Yeah.
Just
and,
lost my plan.
And your double dipping as well. Yeah, sorry. Oh, Lynn, you ruined his day. So, B6. B6 is placement of floating docks. The placement of floating docks shall be in water areas that do not encroach into wetland or buffer areas surrounding defined wetlands in the bay. It just strikes me, and I look for it somewhere else, it strikes me that that's an incomplete development restriction because it does not include navigable channels on the tourney basins, which are mentioned in other places, but not in this context. Unless I missed that one, too.
I think it's telling you where you can't build.
I know. That's my point. Hence...
Can you read that again?
Sure. It says the placement of floating docks. The placement of floating docks shall be in water areas that do not encroach into wetland or buffer areas surrounding defined wetlands in the bay. But I don't see anything anywhere where it talks about prohibiting floating docks in navigational channels or turning basin. I guess you can. I'm going to go anchor a floating dock out there in the turning basin. That should make me popular. So unless somebody sees some reason not to do that, I'll add that to the memo. And finally, actually next to finally, page 35 of the same document, 17.09.040 Supplemental Regulations, item A2, relative to architectural treatment. The design shall protect aesthetic environmental qualities. Who more importantly, who determines them and what are they? Okay, I guess there's universal confusion. So, and then now finally, D on that same sentence, which is the Midway Marina area, as a condition to approval of any permit for development within the Midway Marina area, the city shall require that the State Department of Parks and Recreation include the Midway Marina area in its Morro Bay State Park Master Plan. My question is, how in the world is the city going to force the state to do that? And that's not a rhetorical question. So unless somebody has an answer for me, then we'll put that in the memo. Okay.
Gene? When was the last time the State Park Marina was known as the Midway Marina?
Oh,
70s. Actually, that was its name. Eventually, it changed to State Park Marina, correct? Yeah. We need to change that. That still lives.
So we've been dragging this document around for the last 50 years.
So it seems like it might be a good idea to define the other two districts like we did, the commercial or the fishing district, the CF district, has language in there that describes its location. Could they do that for the other two? I know it's on a chart or on a page with a drawing of everything, but it seems like it would flow better since you're talking about these three districts, that the other two have that language also describing their location.
Yeah, sure. Can you send me an email?
Sure.
Are you not talking about on this page in the left bottom left-hand corner, handwritten in 326, Fishery Sector, the Measure D Zone, north of Beach Street. Visitor Sector, Beach Street, south of Tylands Park. Southern Sector, southern, south of Tylands Park to the State Park Marina. Isn't that what you're referring to?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Dana, but I think you are now in attachment.
I'm in attachment one.
Well, no, I think Dana's in attachment.
I'm in attachment four.
Yeah, Dana's in attachment four.
Oh, okay.
So at the very least, there's an inconsistency of usage. So.
Yeah. You're looking for a written definition of those zones in addition to...
Yeah, I mean, since you have it for the person...
Them being on a map.
It seems like it should be on all three.
Okay. So, please.
Okay.
Okay, anything else? Okay. Wunderbar. Another fine job by the Harbor Department.
Yes.
For real. Okay, that brings us to declaration of future agenda items. Does anybody have an item they would like to declare? Mark.
A couple months ago, I had mentioned that we were looking at primitive camping, and I promised to bring forth something that is a little bit more substantial than my conversation last time. And we've put something together that I'd like to bring for the board's consideration. I'd like to have that agendized for next month.
Can you make a motion?
I move to agendize primitive camping as a potential revenue stream and study review. Review the study for.
You're saying there is a study?
Yes.
Okay. So restate that for me, please.
Review the study for primitive camping for the Morro Bay, for the board's review for potential referral to the city council.
Do you mind including the word revenue in there somewhere?
Absolutely. For revenue enhancement purposes.
Okay. Got it. I think we understand the essence. Is there a second?
I'll second it if I don't have to repeat
that. It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries. Okay, and I have one, which is I'd like to agendize a report from the quota fund, or about the quota, about and from and about the quota fund in the fall of this year. I would say September or October.
After their meeting.
Yeah, and after he gets his data from 2018.
I'll second that.
Okay. Discussion? Okay. None? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None? Carries. Motion to adjourn.
I'll second that.
I can't move it, so.
So moved.
So moved and seconded. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.